Welcome to the Drop-In CEO podcast. I'm Deb Coviello, and as the Drop-In CEO, I drop into businesses and assume the CEO role to enhance the human element and increase the results they achieve. This podcast is about bringing you conversations with expert guests who have achieved their greatest results built on a strong foundation of purpose, values, and elevating people. If you're a business leader, entrepreneur, or even just getting started in business, join us as we build the skills you need to achieve your goals. Hello, everybody. I'm Deb Coviello, and I welcome you to the Drop-In CEO podcast. Today, we're speaking with Elaine Hunkins, who is author of Cracking the Leadership Code, Three Secrets to Building Strong Leaders, which is due out March 2020. He is also a sought-after speaker, consultant, trainer, and coach. Over his 20-year career, he has led over 2,000 groups in 25 countries. Elaine's clients include Walmart, Pfizer, Citigroup, General Electric, State Farm Insurance, IBM, General Motors, and Microsoft. He has designed and facilitated seminars on numerous leadership topics, including team building, conflict management, communication, peak performance, innovation, engagement, and change. Elaine serves on the faculty of Duke Corporate Education and has published over 400 articles on leadership. Elaine, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Deborah. It's great to be here with you today. Thanks.
All right. So for my listeners, I always have a story why I bring these special guests to you. So we were, may I say, maybe speed dating, trying to find podcast guests and he looking for somebody to podcast with. And we stumbled upon each other. But, you know, sometimes we have to take those risks and connect with people that we might not have normally connected with. And when we first spoke, I knew from the start, he makes it very easy to have a conversation. And I think what attracted me was the fact that leadership has to start with a place of building comfort and trust amongst people that you know or maybe don't know, but will very soon. And so I think the conversation about his insights, his business journey, and his thoughts on leadership, I really think are inspirational. And I'm excited to have this conversation with Elaine.
Great. Thanks so much, Deborah. You know, as you talk about the sense of our connection, I love the fact you said we were speed dating. That's a great way to put it. But you know, what's amazing about speed dating is you can tell a lot about a person in a very short amount of time. And so the fact is, you know, within a 5 or 10 minute exchange, you know, our intuition and our sixth sense about people is so strong, particularly if we tune into that. And so as we think about leaders, understanding that it really doesn't matter what business or industry you're in the people business. You know, that's, we all work with people. And so I love the fact that you picked up on that, because to me, you know, connection is the foundation of leadership. Because look, at its core, leadership is a relationship between a person who chooses to lead and a person who chooses to follow.
Yeah. And so if you start from a place of connecting with the humans first, and just, as you say, build that trust and rapport, you never know where it might go from there, whether it's supporting each other, it could be a business transaction, or just a great friendship.
Yeah.
So you have had an amazing business journey. I would love for you to share a little bit about that. And obviously, you're in this world to make an impact. I'd love to know a little bit about the journey and the impact that you're making now.
Yeah, sure. You know, and I think back on everything, you know, I can see how all the points connect together, but it wasn't necessarily a straight line at the time. You know, I certainly wouldn't have imagined myself 25 years ago being where I am and doing what I'm doing. But if I look back and I see the common thread, I have always been really fascinated by why humans do what they do. I mean, we're really kind of odd creatures in terms of what motivates us, where we're rational, where we're irrational. And I've always wondered about this. And, you know, by the time I got to college, I got really interested in human psychology and organizational development. But I also got really interested in theater, because I felt like theater, and I started acting and actually writing plays, was theater when it's at its best, it really holds up a mirror to human nature. And if it's great, we walk away from that changed and we learn something about ourselves. So actually, after I finished college and really wasn't sure what I was going to do, I went on and ended up going to graduate school at an acting conservatory, which was 3 years putting myself under the microscope as a literally as a performer. right? You're performing. How do you perform? And learning a lot about the science of high performance from a very tactical level, right? As an actor, you are your own instrument. And I'm a big believer that as leaders, we are our own instrument, right? It's what we say and what we do and how we say and how we do that creates the impact on people. And so I started from there and then moved into teaching, actually using arts and education, working in high schools and junior high schools with at-risk youth in New York City, and learned a lot, kind of cut my teeth teaching, as it were, for a couple of years in New York. And then from there, moved on to working in corporations and businesses, doing leadership training and organizational development training. And that has been the journey. And as I continued along working with leaders, I started to see patterns of behavior, both of what people did well as what people did poorly. And I noticed that the patterns kept repeating and repeating. And I started taking notes, and the notes turned into stories, and the stories turned into blog posts, and the blog posts turned into chapters, which is now becoming this book that's coming out, because I really wanted to share the patterns that do emerge. And I think that, you know, if leadership was easy, we'd have a lot more great leaders. And the studies I have, I post in my book, last I saw, about 20 to 23% of people believe that the leaders that are leading them are good. So that means we've got a lot of room for improvement. Now, the good news is you've got 20% of people that we can learn from really well. So the challenge is, how can I, if I want to be a better leader, how can I learn from the clues that success has left? And how can I also learn from the clues that mediocrity has left? Because look, we've all familiar probably with lots of mediocre leaders. What are they doing? And how do I avoid falling into those traps? Because I doubt any single one of those people ever woke up and said, today, I'm going to be a mediocre leader. I mean, no one ever thinks and means to do that. And yet we do. So I'm a big believer in, let's look at the good, the bad, the ugly of leadership and take it apart. And then let's put it back together so that we can be more effective.
Wow. So there's so much in that. My paper is already filled halfway with notes. But let's just go back a little bit to that theater part. You talked about acting theater is kind of putting a mirror in front of you to understand human nature. And you also talk about playing to one's tune, you know, bringing out their tune, their way through acting. And what's really interesting about that is you've worked with people to help bring forward their character, to perform at a higher level, to embrace who they are and bring it forward. Yet why in business and industry do we not cultivate that as much? Because we are often taught, this is what you do, these are the rules, the box that you're in. How do you bring that forward? And I would even ask, sooner in a person's career versus maybe those mid and later career people for which then we have to consult and coach?
Yeah, that's a great question, Deb. So it's interesting, right? Because if you think about that, why don't we do that sooner in business? If you ever stop and think about it, Deb, I think a lot of it has to do with the way we're trained to think and, you know, how business people are oftentimes taught to think. Like, for example, have you ever wondered why we love numbers in the business world? I mean, we love them. And if you think, I stopped and asked that question a while ago, like, why are we so in love with numbers? Well, you know, frankly, numbers are a lot less messy than people. I mean, we can measure them. They're always super consistent. Like every day, 7 always shows up. It's always 1 more than 6 and 1 less than 8. You never have to worry about it being anything other than what it is. Whereas people, they're more mysterious, we're murky, we're not sure how they're going to show up, what they're going to do. And so we tend to cultivate this desire to see the world as this mechanical engineering problem to be solved. And if you look back at the history of the Industrial Revolution, I mean, the first leaders in organizations were literally, they were mechanical engineers. The father of this whole field is Frederick Winslow Taylor. And so the belief was that humans were literally these parts in the machine, right? And if you think about it, think about the term we use, human resources. I mean, isn't that the weirdest thing? If you stop and think about, where does that term come from? It's like, oh, we need to get us some new human resources right here. I mean, it's crazy. In the book, I go into this whole background of our inherited leadership legacy. If we look at people as parts, we're missing the third dimension, right? Like we're seeing it in very kind of two-dimensional, but we lose all the depth of what people have. And the irony, of course, is that you could get away with seeing people as parts when you were working where 95% of people were doing manual labor on an assembly line. That's not the world that we're living in. And the only reason that people put up with that kind of command and control leadership was because the work was constant. The pay was okay compared to what else was out there, which was not very much. People didn't have access to what was going on competitively. So there was no LinkedIn. There was no Glassdoor. So you were stuck in this job. And also, if you stayed with your job, you know, shut up, do what you're told, kept your nose clean, you'd have a job for life and probably have a pension at the back end. That world has disappeared. And so where does that leave both employees as well as organizations when it comes to leading in 2020 and beyond? And that's what I'm really concerned and wanted to look at with this book.
Yeah, you know, you struck a chord with me because I'm also a continuous improvement professional. We talk about, and I'm going to geek out a little bit on you, DMAIC methodology, how to solve a problem. We define, we measure, we analyze the numbers and prove and control. Yeah. And there's a little chapter in there about change management. And it's really about, oh, make sure everybody speaks up, make sure you communicate the change. But it's very broad. It's not in depth. And mind you, if you haven't mastered the skill, and you go for your one-on-one with your boss, then they send you out for a class to learn negotiation skills, conflict management. And then barely is there the support system when you come back from that opportunity to say, okay, what'd you learn? Let's put it to practice. How can I coach and mentor you? It's such a big gap. And so for we're quite fortunate for people like yourself that have this insight and help us see the way.
Yeah, well, as you're describing that whole process and that methodology, it sounds like this box ticking exercise, you know, this like, let's go through this, here's the process. And that ultimately, you know, analysis is really a great useful skill. I mean, without analysis, we couldn't find root cause issues. We couldn't create engineering that would create planes that can fly in the sky. And all, I mean, there's amazing things that have happened with analysis and problem solving and engineering. And we don't want to leave things to the point of analysis. The other side of it is we need synthesis, right? We need to be able to rebuild and reconstruct. And at the end of the day, humans are not boxes to be checked off of a list. You know, we're much bigger, deeper, broader than that. And we know when we're being treated like a part of a box to be checked off. We sense it. And so I think the challenge, and I think this is where the performing arts, and you know, my background is an actor in the theater, it's like, why do we go to the theater to see a great movie or a work of art or the opera? It's to be moved, right? And what ultimately drives behavior is emotion. It's not logic and reason, which is what advertising knows all too well. It's like, so we want to be able to, as leaders, you know, there's a reason that we say we want to capture people's hearts and minds. We don't say minds and hearts, we say hearts first, because the heart is the priority. And so we all need to be, if we're in leadership roles, we all need to be amateur psychologists. We have to understand what drives human behavior and how do I, in this role, seek to capture that. And I guess for me, that's the essence of what my work is about, is how do I, as a leader, seek to capture the hearts to help people to create and work willingly towards some kind of a shared purpose.
And so that's why I wanted to have this conversation with you, because I liken that to my thoughts when we talk about influence and inspiration. You can be a good leader, a good manager, and influence by directing, guiding, and showing a better way. And people with the proper training and retraining will follow if a leader lays the path. But the inspiration is something that ignites something from within. And it could be, you know, something that you didn't even see or hear, but something about the message or what you saw that inspired you then leads you to have your own internal thought to think about, what do I want to do with this? And how do I want to make a difference in this journey as part of a team or as a leader? So I love your perspective on this.
Yeah. And to me, what's interesting is you talk about inspiration is the sense of, okay, I mean, that sounds like I could be listening going, okay, that I get it. I want to be inspired. But then what do I do? Like, is it just this magic thing that some people are inspiring and some people aren't? And I actually think, no, actually, there's actually a science behind inspiration, you know, and in fact, part four of the book is called, it's collaboration. I get into all the different human needs that leaders need to address that start to unlock this magic mystery of inspiration. So for example, we all have this need for safety, right? So we have need for, you can start with fiscal safety, and then there's physical safety, and then there's psychological safety. So we all have this need for that. And I look at how you address that. We all have this need for energy, right? We want to be in an environment where we can unleash our energy. And there are things that we can do as leaders to create a high energy culture or environment for people. We all have a need for purpose, and a sense that what we do matters and is bigger than ourselves. And we all have a need for a sense of ownership. So there are things that leaders can do that create this sense of ownership, and people can have autonomy, because we know that when people are making progress towards a meaningful goal, there's no better motivator than that. And so I go through specific tactics and practical tips and techniques that people can use as leaders to start to cultivate those four needs, because it shouldn't be this charismatic, oh, they've got it and I don't have it, inspirational, weird thing. It really needs to get boiled down to, here are the practices, let me understand them, and then start to apply them.
You know, the reason why I love these conversations, I've got a million thoughts in my head. I was going to ask you about a quote that is from your book, but I'm going to go in a different direction. So you make it look so easy. And so obviously you've got a methodology, you've got years, you've got data, you've seen patterns, but I would love to know of a situation where you came into working with a leader or a team or a business unit where it wasn't so easy to help them through your process. And was there an instance where maybe the light went on and somebody got it? What was that like? Do you have a story about that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, part of how I feel like I've learned so much is because I've gotten exposure to so many leaders. And I want to tell you about a guy named Matt. So Matt is a district manager within actually the quick service restaurant industry, fast foods. And he's a district manager. So he oversees 10 stores and he's been a district manager for years and years. And when I met Matt, he was one of 100 district managers within his company. And he happened to be the number one top ranked district manager out of 100. And I said, Matt, that's amazing. And that's why I got to meet him, because he was number one. I said, Matt, have you always been number one? And he laughed at me. Not even close. He said, when I started, I was like 84 out of 100. It's not in good. So I said, so Matt, what changed for you? Like, you were 84, now you're number one. Talk to me. Tell me your story. I want to hear some more. And so what Matt described, he said, when I started, I thought my job, and this is the way he described it. He said, I thought my job was to be the fixer, right? So he would get, you know, because they measure everything, right? So they measure all their key performance indicators, like drive-through wait times, revenue per store. So he would have this battery of metrics, and he could go, he could drive from store to store with his store managers and basically look at the metrics and go, oh, they're not performing. Let me go and fix what's wrong. Let me go tell them what they need to do. So he saw his role and his whole belief, his mindset was, I've got to go in there and tell people what to do and fix this and fix this problem and do this. And he was running himself ragged trying to fix things. And he realized he was doing this and doing this, and it wasn't making things a whole lot better. The turnover in his stores, to the point where there were people who were coming in and out. There were assistant managers. He never even knew their names. He said, I was treating people like worker bees, and they just came and came out. And I realized I had to shift. I needed to shift how I was working. And it was when he made the shift, he realized, he said, you know what I realized was people don't want a fixer. They want a leader, right? They want someone who will guide the process, not to take over the process. And so he started this all, going back to our earlier conversation, he started this with connection. He realized people actually want to know that I care about them. So he started asking them, hey, Deb, how was your weekend? And then if Deb would say, oh, well, you know, I had a great weekend. My daughter turned 12 this week. So suddenly Matt realized, oh, now I know that Deb's daughter is important to her and her family's important. So the next time that he came in to talk to you, you had left them a clue. So he'd say, hey, how's your daughter? How's your family? And so suddenly he started building relationship on commonality. And as people started to feel that he cared about them, and he also changed his approach, instead of being a fixer, he'd come in with the same metrics of what wasn't working. But this time he'd say, well, I'm noticing this. What do you think we should do? And he would let people come up with their own solutions. And he started to cultivate this idea of leader as coach, leader as guide, and letting go of leader as fixer. His number started to go up. And the funniest part of the story to me was Matt described, he said, the amazing thing is I'm number one now. I'm working so much less hard than I used to. It's so much easier and it's so much more fun because I feel like I'm mentoring and I'm cultivating these relationships. And in fact, a number of his store managers have been promoted, are now his peer district managers within the entire company. So I think it's a great example of how the mindset shifts and then the behavior shifts afterwards.
Beautiful story. And I also will share, I used to be a fixer, and it could be situational where people say you need to be very tactical. You need to be able to roll up your sleeves and go in there and fix things. And then the next manager that you have says, you're too much in the weeds. You got to be more strategic. So it's always this, depending on the culture or who's your boss, how do you need to perform? But kudos for the person that has a moment to realize, I need to do something different to get a different result. And sometimes as leaders, we just don't have that pause button. We just go, 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 because that's what everybody's been doing. So I would advocate for anybody, if you feel like you're on that hamster wheel, make sure you pause once in a while. You might want to think about doing things a little differently. And people are beautiful. There's one of you and there's hundreds of them. Think about the beautiful work they can do if you can just help and guide them.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's beautiful. So I want to go a little bit into your book. We're not going to give away your book, but when I looked at some of the quotes that you brought in, I thought a few of them were rather interesting. So this one is very curious to me. You talk about, be vulnerable. You never know who you'll inspire. And there's this struggle that I have that over the years, they talk about, don't get too personal. You don't want to tell everything. You've got to be their leader and manager. Yes, it's good to have a coffee and have a conversation, but showing vulnerability, that was never taught to us. And so I really would love your thoughts on why do you think this is important, or why did you put it in the book?
I put this in here because, and it's interesting, Deb, as you talk about this, you know, many of us, and this is also can be a generational thing about kind of when we came into the workplace, right? The sense of, hey, you know, this is business, right? You got to check your feelings at the door, right? This is a check, you know, which is a funny thing if you stop and think about it, because you can't actually check your feelings at the door. What you can do is you can suppress your feelings at the door, which is exactly what people did. And in fact, Deloitte came out with an interesting study recently, which is 61% of the U.S. workforce feels the need to cover their identity in some way, that they put on some kind of a mask, right? So if you think about just the impact of that. So what we're seeing is that the power of when people feel that they can actually bring their whole selves to work, it makes such a difference. You know, if you look in terms of just the metrics, in terms of performance. So I know this can sound very touchy-feely soft stuff, but there's all sorts of hard business case results that show that when people basically feel safe to be themselves, they perform better. It's just, and on a certain level, I mean, that hopefully makes common sense. I want to tell you a story about where I really learned the power of be vulnerable. You'll never know who you're inspiring. So I was working with a group of 300 flight attendants. I was leading a conference and I was kicking off the conference. I was the MC of the conference and they were going to go off and do some work in some breakout rooms around customer service. But when I was kicking things off, I was welcoming everybody in. And I had learned that this was a global airline. People had flown in, these flight attendants had flown in from literally around the world. And one person said to me, hey, you know, we flew in last night from the Far East, from Asia. So if we're falling asleep here, don't take it personally because we're falling asleep. So anyway, I just heard that. I put it in my back pocket. And then I got into my big MC kind of high energy facilitator mode. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to our customer service conference. Hope you're all doing great. I know you've come from literally around the world. We've got the Asian table up here and this, and I going on and on and on. And at one point, I get interrupted by this kind of really cool rhythm percussion band that comes in. It's all been planned. And I won't go into the whole story of what they're doing. But anyway, I get interrupted. And while they're doing their percussion thing to kind of get the crowd all excited, this guy toward the front raises his hand. And I come over to him. I said, yeah, can I help you? And he turns to me, says, how dare you? How can you treat people that way? And I have no idea what he's talking about. I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm like, at this point now, the blood is rushing to my head because I'm getting screamed at. Like, he says, what are you, some kind of a racist? Now I'm really going crazy. Like, what? He's like, you call that the Asian table. Like, how rude. You wouldn't call it the, and then he used the N-word, the N-word table. And he started like using, I'm like, what is it? Like, literally, like, and he's shouting at me and he's cursing at me. And I'm literally just, I'm having this amygdala hijack, right? Where my brain is just like, what the heck is going on? And he just kept going. And obviously people around him could hear this and other people were distracted while this is going on. And one of my colleagues was in the back of the room, the designer who designed the program with me. I went back to her and I said, Cynthia, can you tell me what's coming next? Because this guy in the front just cursed me out and I have no idea what I'm supposed to do right now. Because I was literally just out of my mind. And I had about a minute and a half to figure it out because they were about to finish. The band was going to finish and I had to figure it out. And all I could think was, well, be honest. Like, instead of blaming this guy or thinking he's a wacko or weirdo, is thinking, okay, I can see how what he was trying to get at. And all I can do, we're talking customer service, all I can do is try to recover. So what I did, as I said to the group, okay, folks, before we move on, I just need to stop for a moment and apologize. I said something earlier that seemed to offend people, and I just want to let you all know that was not my intention whatsoever. And all I could do is be honest about it with people, and people were fine with it at the moment. But what was amazing was over the next 2 days, how many of those flight attendants came over to me and said, you know, we've come to a lot of these kind of conferences, and for the most part, all we hear of this is like, you know, kind of company propaganda, and it's kind of a lot of BS. But when you were that real and that vulnerable in that moment, I trusted that, and I trusted you. And I must have had literally 30 different people came over to me. And what that showed me was by me letting my guard down and just being honest that, you know what, I screwed up and I'm sorry, is how that goes a long way. You know, I think a lot of us as leaders think that we have to wear the superhero cape, that we have to know it all, do it all, be it all, and just kind of keep going through. And what I realized was, you know, being real, being human, admitting when I might have made a mistake or if I did make a mistake and just showing up in that way. So that was a huge moment for me about the power of vulnerability and the power of authenticity and how much it leads to connection and people, their willingness to follow.
It's funny, you know, as we're speaking today, and your episode will probably come out in the April timeframe, an episode aired today, Jackie Lauer, and she's a business coach, consultant, and full of energy. And she too also talked about being vulnerable because it's so uncomfortable. But in those moments, and I remember her saying this, as you lean into it, you get tremendous insight, or to your point, tremendous validation, and you build relationships, and you probably had a better impact over the course of that conference. So it's challenging, but you know what? Go to the other side. It could be beautiful.
It is challenging. And you have those moments. And like I like to say that, you know, leaders get comfortable with being uncomfortable. I mean, if you're not in that place of stretching yourself, you're probably just phoning it in at a certain point. I mean, you can't, I'm not saying you have to be that vulnerable all the time, every day, 24/7. And how can I be human with people? Because I think when you show that, you give people permission to realize that they're human too, and that you give them the courage next time to step up and have the difficult conversation, to realize that we don't have to hide behind these masks of, oh, how are you? I'm fine. How are you? It's all okay. You know, there's more to it than that.
Yeah. And if you build trust with people that are in your sphere and you work with, it's okay to let your hair down a little bit. Obviously, you don't want to be a Debbie Downer or whoever that might be.
Yeah.
But at the same time, allow people to look inside or look under the hood and understand who you really are. So that was fantastic. Yeah. So I picked up on something. Sometimes when we go to the human side or things that are not necessarily business related, you learn a lot about people. So I am curious if you could share a little bit about, I believe it's a passion project. You have been or were a certified co-leader for the Mankind Project International. And I got a sense from your bio that this was meaningful to you. So how was it? And what do you bring from that maybe into your business life or your personal life?
Oh my gosh, it's been very influential. So I got involved with the Mankind Project in 1994. So at the time I was 25 years old. And so by the clock, 25 years old, I remember at the time thinking, okay, so I'm an adult man. I didn't feel like that at the time. I was like, okay, where's the instructions? I'm an adult man. How does this work? And so one of my friends had actually gone through this training with the Mankind Project a couple of years earlier. And he was in my grad school class, a guy named John. And what impressed me with John is after he came back from this training and he was going through some ongoing training with the organization was the level of clarity and power that I saw that John had in his communication. He was not like he was steamrolling power. I meant like clarity of just clean, clear, honest, strong communication. I thought, wow, I wish I could say things that clearly. And John said, you should check out this training. So the purpose of the Mankind Project is, you know, the founders of it, they believed, I mean, they came of age kind of during the early 1970s, and they saw all the great stuff that was happening around women's liberation and feminism, and they were huge supporters of that. And they went, you know, it'd be great if someone did something like this for men, because men actually could use something like this. And they went, someone needs to do this. Someone needs to do this. They went, I guess that someone would be us. So these were two therapists and an ex-Marine put together a training they called the New Warrior Training Adventure. And the idea that being the old warrior fought their battles on the outside, the new warrior starts by fighting the battles on the inside. And so they created a training that was actually modeled on an archetypal initiation for men. And the idea is that for thousands of years, tribal cultures have been initiating boys into men as part of the society. And what they realized, because you had all these boys with all this raging testosterone, that they needed to channel that so they could be a good, productive member of the community. And if they didn't, they would be taking that energy in destructive places. And you see examples in modern society of what we'll call immature initiation. So things like fraternity hazings, right? Or joining gangs, right? So these are all examples of, there's this yearning, you know, and I'm talking about, now I'm not saying, now, by the way, this is nothing to discount anything around the feminine archetype. And like, it's, there's nothing anti-feminine. I just want to hear, just be really clear on that. And men, you know, if you look at, I mean, just look at some of our political leaders today. You know, you wonder, like, if boys don't get mature, where do they end up? They just become bigger boys with bigger toys and et cetera, et cetera. So all of which to say is, so I got involved with this. And then what I noticed, I went through this training, which really takes you on this journey of taking a look at being a mature masculine person for our time. What does that mean? And it meant around having a clear mission of service in the world. It meant understanding emotional intelligence, like what are your basic feelings of mad, scat, sad, scared, happy? Can you identify what those feel like? Can you articulate those in words? I mean, some basic emotional intelligence that they taught. And I also got to see these powerful men as role models of, oh, these are the men I've been waiting for my whole life, where I could see men who were both strong in a kind of traditional sense, but also super sensitive, right? Men who could be active and dynamic in the world, and yet at the same time being very caring and nurturing, and right? So those things don't need to be mutually exclusive. And I went, oh, these are my people. Thank you for showing up. And so I got really involved with the organization. I started staffing weekends and co-leading groups and gotten really involved in group psychology and facilitation through the Mankind Project, which led me to my passion and work. And actually going on that initial weekend led me to my life mission, right? So we do this whole program where we help people to discover their own personal mission. And for me, my mission is to create a vibrant and alive world by kindling the fire of brilliance in people. And what's amazing is I discovered that mission in 1994, and some people's missions change over time. Mine hasn't. So I feel really so fortunate to have found something that really sticks for me. So has that informed my business world work? Absolutely. I mean, the fact is, when I talk about kind of going deeper with a business audience, like, yeah, we will go deeper. But the kind of work I've done at the personal level, because this is obviously outside of a business context, people are, I mean, the level of depth of the human psyche is unbelievable. I mean, people's ability to go through unbelievable amounts of trauma and come out the other side and be resilient is a testament to me of the human condition. And the fact that we can support each other in that way is amazing. And so I feel privileged to have learned from some of the greatest people I know. And I see my role is to share that with next generations to come.
You know, the strongest thing that came out at the end, but I had it in my notes because when we first spoke, it was beautiful. And it was the kindling of brilliance in your work. And when I think about the story that you just shared with me, regardless if it was rooted in maturing of the men, emotional intelligence and their purpose and their place in this world, it absolutely resonates with any young professional, anybody who you finish your trade school, you finish high school, you go into the workforce, or you have the opportunity to get a college education and move on. And then they expect you, okay, get your job, maybe take a year off, travel the world. And now you have to be a productive citizen of the world and have an adult mindset. And sometimes I almost feel like there needs to be almost an apprenticeship, moving yourself into that adult mindset. And what a beautiful place if somebody could get early coaching and mentoring, whether it's through something like the Mankind Project or other. Again, not promoting this, but some kind of support where they can find their kindling of brilliance in the work that they're meant to do as an adult.
Yeah. I mean, I remember I got very involved in personal development early on. And I remember either listening to an audio recording or a book of Jim Rohn, who's kind of well known in the world of personal development. And I remember him saying, make sure you work on yourself as hard as you work on your job, right? Because basically the idea was that when you work on yourself, it pays dividends. And I think it's very easy for so many of us to get caught up in climbing that ladder of success, whatever we think that is outside. And it's so useful for us, I think, particularly early in our career, but frankly, anywhere along the way, is to take that time and work on yourself, you know, to continue to develop yourself. You know, how do you become a more emotionally intelligent and articulate person? How do you learn to understand what your strengths are and how you can shore up your liabilities? I mean, I'm certainly really much clearer on what some of those are and what I can do to mitigate against some of the areas I'm not as strong, and also realizing what my strengths are. So these are such useful things that end up impacting and influencing so many parts of your life.
That is exactly why I wanted to have this conversation. It was so energetic, so full of nuggets that I hope everybody got every bit of it out of this conversation. So when we think about, is there anything else that we may not have talked about that you want to share with the listeners? And if not, where can people find you if they want to reach out to you?
I'll share one little nugget. We kind of touched on it slightly, but I just want to be really clear about it because I'm a big believer that great leaders make their implicit assumptions explicit, which is, I'd say if there's one thing that you can do to accelerate your leadership development, it's seek out people who will give you honest feedback and then take it and then act on it. So that would be if there was a nugget that I could suggest that you take and do. And the challenge, of course, is take that feedback. And when you hear it, to let it soak and wash over you. And the only response is thank you, because it's a gift, but you have to be willing to ask for it. So that would be the thing I'd suggest. And if people want to find more about me and the book, I'd suggest you go to the book webpage, and you can also link from there. It is www.crackingtheleadershipcode.com, crackingleadershipcode.com. And while you're there, you can actually read the first chapter, and you can explore and get a little taste of the book while you're there. So that'd be the place. And then from there, you can find all sorts of links to me there and find my name. Again, Alain Hunkins. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. I do post and things there as well.
All right. Fantastic. Alain, this has been quite enjoyable for me. I just love you and I being able to interact. So much wisdom in what you shared with us. I know the listeners will truly enjoy it. Thank you for being my guest. Truly enjoyable, Alain.
Hi, Deb. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. Be well. Thank you for listening to the Drop-In CEO podcast. I hope you are inspired by our conversation and can apply what you heard to your business or career goals. For more information about our consulting or coaching services, please visit my website at dropinceo.com or visit our Drop-In CEO Facebook group to continue the conversation. Now go out, lead, inspire, and achieve your goals.